When he stepped out and closed the door, my jaw dropped. What the hell is going on? I thought. The man, who introduced himself as Bill Walters, looked just like John Davis. His hair was the same color and style, he had the same eyes, the same strange olive skin, thick big glasses and yes, even those same beige pants. Immediately I was on guard. Obviously I was wrong in the assumption that I would be left alone by merely moving from Vancouver. Over the next few hours we talked about a number of issues. Bill asked a lot of questions about what I was told and he especially wanted to know about alien technology. I kept my answers as vague as possible since I felt I couldn't fully trust him. Maybe I was insane, who knew? I asked myself this question so many times that it was like having a recording on a loop in my head. At the first opportunity I got Sandra on her own and I told her about John Davis. And then I asked her how much she knew about Bill. Her knowledge was limited but she did say that he seemed to have a lot more information than most people did. As far as she knew he was a computer programmer whom she met at a UFO meeting. They quickly became friends and poof, there they were talking to me. And throughout the day I attempted to get more information from Bill. Just like with John Davis, Bill was vague in many areas. I was frustrated by his lack of intent on sharing what he knew with me. It was clear as the day went on that he was aware that I was holding back with him. Before heading back to Vancouver, Chandru and Bill suggested we have dinner. After we ate, we all stood up to leave and Bill handed me his business card. You work with John Davis? I can't believe it. I was incredulous, both John and Bill worked at the same computer company. He looked at me blankly and said, no. What do you mean? You work with a guy named John Davis. Still he insisted he did not know anyone named John. Quickly my fear turned to anger and I said, look. I know you work with John Davis in a small office with about 8 other guys, you're all into UFOs and you work at a computer company installing supercomputers, so what the hell is going on here? Who are you? Finally, oh, right, John, yes I work with John, I am terrible with names, sorry. Bill wouldn't go any further into how he knew John. He quickly paid for his dinner, stating that they had to run if they wanted to catch the ferry. Call me if you ever come to Vancouver, he said. I would really like to hear more of your story. As I watched them leave I stood motionless while my mind swirled with questions. Who were these guys? I can concede that they both have the same occupation and even the same workplace. However, the fact that they both look the same and even wear the same strange beige pants is just a bit too much. Over the next few months I went back to Vancouver a number of times and I called John on what had happened. As always, he seemed to have an answer for everything. Bill was forgetful, he said, and lived in his own headspace. As for them looking alike, he said that people did tell him that sometimes. The more I pressed, the less he talked. I also called Bill in an attempt to find out more. No one in my circle of friends ever met both Bill and John. I was the only one that knew them both. Some of the UFO people I knew met one or the other, but only I had met both, which made it hard to convince people that I wasn't crazy. My time in Victoria was short-lived as I was more comfortable living in Vancouver where I had my friends around me. After only 6 months I packed up and moved back. I was intent on keeping a low profile in an attempt to stay out of the spotlight of the UFO phenomena. And this didn't mean, however, that I didn't keep in touch with the people I already made friends with. Nor did it mean I was no longer searching for answers. About this time Sandra told me about a UFO conference in Tucson, Arizona. It was to be the first UFO Congress. I immediately decided to attend. Another abductee I met at one of the abductee meetings I held, Kathy, was also going. We decided to share a room to offset the cost of the trip. It wasn't long before we were on the plane to Arizona. I was excited to be attending in anticipation of the people I might meet who may have had similar experiences as me. Hours later the plane landed and we went to the hotel to get settled in. I quickly unpacked and went downstairs to roam around and talk with people, telling some of them pieces of my story. It was then that I realized I was different from many of them. I seemed to have more memories of my alien contacts, and my thoughts were clearer on a number of facts. Most people seemed confused about what had actually happened during their experience. I decided early on in the day that I would have to be careful about how much I said. I was still being cautious for a number of reasons, one of which was that for the past few months all my mail had come to my home damaged, in other words, opened. The person I was living with knew nothing about my experiences or what I was into, and when he noticed the regularity of my damaged mail, he said he didn't want to know about it, so I never told him. I felt that opening up too much at the conference with strangers might not be a good idea considering past events. I worked the conference rooms and spoke to many people. I then went into an art room and struck up a conversation with one of the artists by the name of Peter Clark. His work was amazing, and I especially enjoyed the detail in his work. The large poster-sized picture of an alien with big black eyes was what caught my attention. The artwork demanded attention, and as I looked at it, it gave me the feeling the alien was friendly. It was in the middle of a conversation with him that I felt a tap on my shoulder and a voice in my right ear. "I hear you have an interesting story. I would really like to hear about it sometime." As I turned to see who was speaking to me, I took a breath of frustration. There he was, man number 3. Just like Bill and John, he had the same hair color and style, eye color, olive skin tone, glasses and, yes, you guessed it, those same beige pants. "Damn," I thought, "will this never end?" I told the man that I would talk with him some other time. For the next few hours he was always in my vicinity, watching, waiting, carrying a black backpack with him at all times. Without speaking to him, I went up to the room at the end of the night to find Kathy already there, lying in bed. We had just begun to talk about our day when she brought up what she called something peculiar she had seen that day. "Miriam, have you seen the guy that has been around here today? He looks just like Bill. He has the same hair, glasses, skin." She sat straight up in bed and said, "He even has the same beige pants." I told her that I had seen him also, and he approached me to talk with him. I was happy she saw him, because up until that day I was the only one who had seen more than one of these men. I was ecstatic because it confirmed that I was seeing these men clearly. Both Kathy and I had many conversations about our disbelief over the similarities of these men. Over the next 5 days this man followed me almost everywhere, and we talked briefly on several occasions. I felt it was in my best interest to find out what I could about him. He told me during our conversations that he was a computer programmer. Big surprise. He said he was writing a book on alien technology and wanted to know what I knew about it, asking all the same type of questions that Bill and John had. There were many people, complete strangers, who, over those 5 days, came to me and told me that I was being followed. Some of them were clearly concerned for my safety. I thanked them and told them I wasn't concerned. I had come to the conclusion that if these men meant me harm, they would have done it by now. Even stranger was that there were two of these guys at the conference. In both cases they had the same hair, glasses, skin tone, and yes, beige pants. They also carried identical black backpacks. The one that talked to me was taller. The short one would run every time I would get close to him. I guess he wasn't supposed to make contact with me in any way, at least, that's what I assumed. During this time some of the people I met tried to get a picture of the short man for me. If he saw us he would leave and sometimes literally run away. In the end I did manage to get a decent picture of the tall, clone-like man and a profile picture of the shorter one. Comparing the photos, one would think they were twins, with the exception of their height. At one point during the conference I had a long coffee with the tall clone. My intention was to try and find out as much as I could about him. I asked why he was so interested in the technology aspect of this phenomenon. He told me he was writing a book on the subject, ABCs of UFOs. It made sense, but I didn't trust him. Our conversation revolved around what I had been told by the aliens. I gave him bits of information in an attempt to gather my own information from him. One thing he was adamant about was that I should not go to the Four Corners area. He told me it was too early to go there and that I would not be able to accomplish what I needed to do. It's not safe for you at this time, he said. I really had no idea what he meant, but I felt as though he was warning me to stay away from there, at least for the time being. When I asked him to go into more detail as to why I should stay away, he refused to be clear with his answer. He did, however, talk about the military presence in the area and the underground bases, both of which I was well aware of because the aliens told me and showed me these when I was with them. When I got back to Vancouver, it was with guns loaded. Now I had ammunition for Bill and Johnson's Kathy saw the clones in Tucson. I pressed Bill for answers and he finally did share some interesting insights. Apparently, at some point, he had been in the United States military. He told me that he was part of a mind-altering program that took place in the 1970s. The program had deeply moved him, changing his life. It was one of the main reasons he got involved in the research of the UFO phenomenon. I sat in a restaurant with him while he told me tales of his time with the military and that he knew people that worked in the FBI and CIA. And his didn't surprise me since I had highly suspected this for some time already. At one point during our conversation, Bill asked me how I meditated, so I told him in some detail, step by step. I only ever use white light, I said. When I ground myself to Middle Earth, I grab onto green crystals to hold me to the Earth. When I told him this, he seemed surprised that I would do this. Have you been to the center of the Earth? He asked. I astral traveled there with an alien guide. He told me that he was surprised I saw Middle Earth, as not many people have been there before. He said that he too saw the green crystals, only he implied it was in body, not spirit. This in-depth conversation almost didn't take place. Before he opened up to me, I told him that if he didn't start talking and being straight with me, I would leave and tell everyone that he was not to be trusted. It was our first real conversation, as well as one of the last. My relationship with John was more established than with Bill, so when I approached him about my questions and concerns, I thought I may get more information from him. At the time, both he and Bill were taking a lot of trips to California and then on to Russia. He told me they were helping to put supercomputers in place for a Russian government project. I demanded that he tell me how he knew as much as he did about UFOs and aliens. He explained that everyone in his office was interested in them and that was where he got most of his information. I wasn't pleased with his lack of explanation and pressed him further. As I had with Bill, I told John that unless he opened up with me, I wouldn't speak to him again. John seemed to have an outrageous answer to every question, including that all his information came from Bill. He told me about the government's technology that enabled them to listen to telephone conversations, listening for key words. If they heard any of these words, they would automatically record the information to be assessed at a later date. He told me that the government of Russia and the USA had remote viewing programs, which Bill was apparently involved with for a short time. Not long after I confronted Bill and John, they slipped away into oblivion. No one ever heard from them again. After Kathy and I started talking to people about the men in Tucson, I think they knew their cover was blown and they had to leave the UFO scene in Vancouver. After the conference, I sent a picture of the tall clone to a contact I made there. She in turn sent it to a friend of hers in another city in the USA who complained of being followed by a man with a similar profile. The woman was apparently shaken when she received the picture because the clone looked exactly like the man that was following her. I tried to get a picture of Bill but was never successful in doing so. I did, however, have a couple of pictures of John from before the conference. When I compare the three different men in the pictures, I can see that they do have some striking similarities. The fact that they all have the same beige pants only adds to the bizarre intrigue. Shortly after John and Bill disappeared, I was back at work at a cafe tilde copyright job. One day I looked up and there he was, man number 5. Damn. Would it never end? I treated him like any other customer at the counter while thinking, He better not talk to me about anything other than the ordinary if he knows what's good for him. He had the same hair color and style, eyes, glasses, skin tone and yes, those damn pair of beige pants. I found out over the next few weeks that his name was Seth. He came in on a regular basis and always had a quick chat with me at the counter while he got his food. Our conversations were about mundane things like the weather. I did, however, find out through our conversation that he worked for a computer company. They all worked for computer companies. Who were these guys? I thought if they wanted to hurt me they would have done so already. I did my best not to let it bother me. I wondered what it was that made me so important to have all the attention I had had over the past few years. I decided that it was in my best interest to step out of the UFO community completely and stop telling people my story. I felt that if I kept talking I may be in danger and I wouldn't be able to complete the mission I was given by the aliens, to tell people who they were. I broke off almost all contact with the people I had met in the UFO community. It was a decision that made me feel safe again. Slowly, all of the strange attention I was having slipped away and I was left to live my life. Except for the presence of Seth. He stayed in my life and no matter where I was he seemed to find me. If I changed jobs or moved, it didn't matter. Every time I booked a flight to go anywhere for the following 12 years I would run into him, usually within 3 days. He would ask me if I had any trips planned and where I was going, what I would do when I got there, etc. It was normally a brief conversation. Once we chatted for 2 or 3 minutes I wouldn't see him again until the next trip. I drifted back into daily life as I tried to blend in. When the time to begin the work came, I would know, and so I let go of the UFO world in order to mesh with society again as I quietly waited. Arizona spirals. For 12 years I stayed out of the limelight after making a conscious decision to step away from anything and anyone who was involved with UFOs or aliens in 1991. I woke up one morning knowing it was time to begin my work again for the aliens. I always knew the day would come when I would get a message to return to work for them. And that day arrived as of 2003. The last time I was in Arizona was in 1991. I was there for the UFO conference in Tucson. I knew I would be traveling to the Four Corners area at some point in my life but I stayed away until 2003 partly due to the warning from the clones at the conference. He told me I should wait a few years before traveling there. My interaction with him, as well as those with the other clones, made me heed his warning. I always knew that when, and if, the time was right I would know. I woke up one morning in early January 2003 and began to think about going to Arizona and the Four Corners. Over and over I thought about what this area would hold for me. It began to creep into my every waking thought. 4 months passed and every day the desire to travel to Arizona grew stronger. The aliens had given me a great deal of information regarding this area in 1988. One of the most crucial bits of information was that the Four Corners area would be important to me as well as to others like myself in the end times. It was there, I was told, that others like myself would gather. It would be the safe lands near the end. I decided I had to look past my fear and experience it for myself now. I knew that in order to visit all the areas I wanted to, I would have to rent a car. I decided to camp along the way to make the trip less expensive. Both the camping and long driving would be a first for me, so I decided to ask a friend to come along. Most of my friends were either busy working, having babies, or didn't have money for a trip, so I decided to ask a new friend, Carrie, if she might be interested. She was a great girl that I'd met through some mutual friends. Although she was in her early 20s and I in my late 30s, we bonded quickly. As she had been laid off from her secretarial job, I knew she was free to go on a vacation. I called her and asked if she might be interested in a 10-day camping tour of the Four Corners area. She said it sounded great and the idea of me paying for the rental car made it all the more appealing to her. I quickly found a great deal on plane tickets to Phoenix. Prior to paying for them, I called Carrie and told her I wanted to share a story with her before she made a final decision. I was nervous at the thought of telling her about my UFO experiences, but I knew it was important to do so. We decided to meet the next day to talk things over. The following afternoon we met for coffee on Commercial Drive. We stepped outside the coffee shop onto the busy city street as I explained the importance of sharing my story with her before we left. I felt the need to be honest, so if she felt at all uncomfortable, or thought I was nuts, she could opt out of the trip. I could see that the build-up to my story confused Carrie. I asked her to please allow me to tell the whole story before she began asking me questions. We turned down a side street that had less cars and foot traffic. It was the perfect day to be out for a walk. The sun shone as we passed the old houses with flower gardens out front. It helped me to relax while I slowly explained why I wanted to make this journey to the Four Corners area. Sharing my story of alien encounters for the first time with people always made me nervous. After only a few minutes, Carrie interrupted me. "Miriam, I don't think you're crazy at all. There is so much we don't know about this world. You're the first person I have met that said they've had alien contact, but that doesn't mean I don't believe you." I was so happy and somewhat surprised to hear her response. As we walked, we talked about several subjects that were controversial, from conspiracies to aliens. I was somewhat surprised by her knowledge because it was far greater than I expected. I ended our conversation by asking her to think about it overnight before she made a final decision about traveling with me. She told me she didn't need to think about it, but I insisted. Carrie called early the next day to reconfirm that she was comfortable with everything I shared with her and then asked, "What day do you want to leave?" After I hung up the phone, I paid for the flight to Phoenix. I knew that something lay just around the corner. After 12 years of being out of the UFO community, I knew this trip would be the first step back into the strange world of aliens. I felt somewhat anxious knowing I was going to the area that was extremely important to them. They had said to me, "You will lead great numbers of people back to the safe lands." It was time for me to see the area that was so closely tied to my role in the cosmic UFO community. In the days prior to leaving, I tried to stay focused on planning the journey. It was great being able to plan this type of trip with Carrie because we were both willing to accommodate each other's desired destinations. And I told Carrie that out of everything we did, I had only two requests. We had to drive past a particular mountain, Ship Rock, and we had to drive through Hopi Land in Arizona. Her requests were to go to Santa Fe in New Mexico and visit Meteor Crater. I knew that over 10 days we would have no problem accommodating both our wishes. Prior to leaving, I felt I had to read some of my notes from my writing of 1988/89/90. I looked for any reference to a man named Harold. When I found them, I read the passages in detail. The aliens gave me specific information about this man, as well as details as to how and where I would meet him. I felt that if and when I did meet him, it would be in one of two places: the Four Corners area of Arizona or Peru. It had been years since I thought about the possibility of ever meeting him, so I wanted to refresh my memory about the details of who I was looking for. I told no one before I left Vancouver of the remote possibility of this encounter with Harold. Carrie and I were off to Phoenix the morning of May 18th. I was excited and nervous at the same time. I didn't share the apprehension I was feeling about our journey with Carrie. My life had intermingled with the aliens for many years, and now, after a long hiatus from them, I was heading straight back into their world. Our plane arrived in Phoenix 2 hours late, the first change to our plan. As a result of being late, the car we'd booked was given to someone else. Since it was a holiday weekend, nothing was available. Left with little choice, we took a taxi to a hotel for the night. We were told they would have a car available for us in the morning. We had a slow start to our day because of the car delay. Finally, by midday, we were heading north to see Dana. After hours of ridiculous bumper-to-bumper traffic, the car reached the top of a crest, and what we saw was amazing. It literally took my breath away. For years I had heard stories of how spectacular the seed in an area was. Pictures could never have captured the mind-blowing deep red rock formations that lunged from the earth towards the sky. These massive structures dotted the drive into the area. We could easily see why Cedar would be considered an energy power point on the planet. Our first stop was an information center. After wandering around inside and picking up some pamphlets, I spoke to a woman at the counter. I asked her where she would go if she was traveling in the area. I explained that we were looking for places that were not high-profile tourist areas. Her number, one suggestion was a place called Mesa Verde. I was excited as she told us about the ancient cliff dwellings in the southwest corner of Colorado. After a brief conversation, Carrie and I decided it certainly was a place to put on our must-visit list. We left and headed back to the horrific traffic, trying to reach Flagstaff. We camped in Flagstaff after pulling in late that night. Although we knew it got cold overnight in the desert, we were still shocked at how cold it was as we shivered the whole night away. Early the next morning we crossed the desert on Route 180, heading east towards Albuquerque. Along the way we stopped to see the Painted Desert, Meteor Crater and the Petrified Forest. The Arizona desert began to fill our souls with a deep respect and love for the land. The area was rich with color and mystery around every corner. We quickly understood that there were two kinds of people in the world, those that saw nothing but sand and cactus and those that saw the life and beauty. We were the latter. It was about 5 p.m. when we crossed the Arizona border into New Mexico and stopped in Gallup for gas and water. Carrie went into the store for water while I waited in the car and looked over the map. When Carrie returned, we talked about our driving route. It was clear that we didn't have enough time to see Mesa Verde and go to Santa Fe. We decided that we could see a city any old time, but the history and mystery of the cliff dwellings would be a rare sight. When we resumed driving, we took the famed Route 666. Carrie and I had a laugh about the number of the highway. We had been told they were renaming it in a couple of weeks. Maybe people didn't feel comfortable driving down a numbered route with a negative association. I was so excited that I felt like a child waiting to open Christmas presents. Before we left Vancouver, I had briefly told Carrie the story of Shiprock and the aliens. Back in 1988, when I was taken, the aliens had shown me an image of Shiprock. I was on the craft when they told me that one day I would travel to where it was. For a long time after my highway experience, I wondered how on earth I would find this place. It wasn't until 2 years later, when a friend gave me a magazine from the Sedonan area, that I learned its name. Before taking our trip to the Four Corners area, I did some research on Shiprock on the internet. The information was limited, but it did inform me that Shiprock was sacred to the Navajo people. It was Shiprock, the Navajo believe, that brought their people to the area and this world. The sun was low on the horizon. Orange hues began to come to life against the desert sky. It was then that I first saw the outline of Shiprock in the distance. My breathing became erratic as we inched towards its form. There it was, exactly as I remembered. When we got close, I stopped the car to look at the beautiful silhouette reaching for the sky in the otherwise flat desert. I felt excitement rising inside me as I saw the detail in crisp focus. There, in front of my eyes, I could see the three peaks jutting upward from behind the rather flat slope leading up one side. The emotional wave that hit me was so strong that I began to cry. "Hush, air it is," I thought. "It is real and it looks exactly as it did when the aliens showed it to me." After I had time to calm down, Carrie and I took a few pictures and then jumped into the car to continue heading north towards Farmington. Night crept over the desert as we drove in silence. It had been an extremely long day of driving and we were both exhausted. Since it was so late, we decided it would be best if we got a cheap hotel for the night. I was grateful for the fatigue as it allowed me to get some sleep without thinking about aliens, Shiprock or the endless possibilities of my fate. Early the next morning we were excited to be on our way to the ancient cliff dwellings. The drive to Mesa Verde only took a couple of hours as we crossed from New Mexico into the state of Colorado. The green meadows were postcard perfect through the mountainous area that led to our destination. I wondered at the beauty as we drove past rolling mountains, horses, old wooden fences and the grass meadows, which looked blue because of the tiny flowers that blanketed them.